As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Total Soccer Show and the newest installment of Listener Questions. My name is Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, we have a man who answers listener questions like Liverpool win Merseyside derbies convincingly. Taylor Rockwell.
Oh, that's high praise to start. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome. I feel like I always put a lot of praise on Joe and not enough on you and Graham, so I'm going to reverse that today. Is that
yeah,
okay?
In your face, Joe.
I'm also going to praise Joe.
Nah. Don't worry about that.
Also here, on that note, is a man who answers listener questions like Bernardo Silva, scores winners against Aston Villa, with precision and style, Graham Ruthven.
See, praise, I don't like praise. It makes me uncomfortable.
Oh my God.
And I'll just say thank you, Ryan, and we'll just move on.
Very well. Also here is a man who answers listener questions like Neil Morpay scores bicycle kicks against West Ham, with accuracy and devastating consequence, Joe Lowry.
Oh, Ryan, these were all beautiful, and I just appreciate Graham squirming under the lightest compliment. Hello.
Hello, Joe. Graham, coming back to you, what would you like me to do, insult or praise? Which is your preference?
See, to get to sleep at night, and this is not even a joke, I listen to, like, white noise on like noise cancelling headphones, and so if we could just have my introduction could just be white noise, that would soothe me and calm me down.
So walk me through this. How does that work? Do you like set it on a timer for like a couple of hours? Because it wasn't I think Wayne Rooney, who can only sleep on an airplane if he lies on the floor of the airplane because of the noise and vibration.
Wait, hold on. In the aisle, Wayne Rooney.
Sorry, Wayne. Can I just step over you to get to the bathroom, please? Okay, sorry.
Exactly. I'm sure I read a story somewhere. I'm gonna have to Google it in a minute. That Wayne Rooney sleeps on the floor of the airplane, maybe in his PJ. I don't know. PJ's in his PJ.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that's like a private jet floor, not the like. Yeah. He's not flying coach and like strewn about in the cabin.
Yeah, I can just imagine like the car getting pushed into like the top of his head as he's lying on the aisle.
So Graham, is that what you're like? You're on the floor with your white noise headphones on?
Yes, that's exactly like what I do, correct.
And to be clear, by white noise, we just mean Billy Gilmore ASMR, right? I assume we're on the same page with that?
Yeah.
Okay,
of course.
Cool.
White noise is what you get when you go to the mall in Arizona, isn't it, Joe?
I mean, at least a good chunk of it. Yeah, that's about right.
Graham, it does explain why your Spotify most played was just white noise for the top 10 songs.
It was in the top 20, and then the rest was just Coco Melon, which is why I didn't share any of... By the way, I have to clarify, it's my daughter listening to Coco Melon, not myself.
Sure.
Yeah, yep. But I didn't share my Spotify Unwrapped.
Graham, you know how I know that you're a parent? It's how? Because you say things like Coco Melon and expect everyone to know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know what it is either.
What? It's my life.
What is Coco Melon?
Coco Melon is like just wee little songs for children, and they're like hour-long episodes. So you just stick it on for the whole day. And there's a little baby and a family and everything in it. And it's my daughter's life.
I am now picturing your daughter watching Cocomelon while you watch your 12 soccer games at the exact same time. Is that how it works? Do you just have a wall of screens and one of them is Cocomelon?
Yes, exactly.
Perfect.
I think his daughter's room is also a wall of screens. One's got Peppa Pig, one's got Cocomelon. It, like, it's learning from the old man to multi-screen.
Oh.
Anyway, we have derailed very quickly on this listener episode question. We should probably get back on track and answer some of our listeners' questions. Thank you very much to those who have submitted. TotalSockShow.com if you want to do so as well. We go first to Richard Rolson. For MLS to take the next step in its evolution, does it need to take better control of its playoffs, asks Richard. This year, MLS playoffs saw almost every team playing twice before the Revolution even had played a game. Does MLS need to be more confident in their scheduling and place their games on dates that seem to build off each other so fans can better know when games will be played? And is there a better build up? I think Revs fan Sailor might agree with Richard here that it might need restructuring. We're speaking just before the conference finals taking place. We're speaking just after the Revolution played NYCFC in the last conference semi. That was 23 days after their last regular season game, Taylor. Over 3 weeks after their last regular season game, they had to wait to play their first playoff. I actually ran the numbers and it seems like that's the longest break we've had in MLS, certainly in the last few years. 2019, NYCFC and LAFC waited 17 and 18 days, respectively, to play their first playoffs because they got the buys. Taylor, your thoughts on structure and timing of the playoffs?
I think it's always a confusing thing when it comes to Major League Soccer playoffs, that sometimes they go very long. Back when we had the two legs home and away, you ended up getting stretching into mid-December. Here we are again with them in December. But I do think it tends to kind of fluctuate a bit much for my liking. I look at other leagues in the United States, like the NFL, you sort of always know what that structure is going to be. You know how it's going to work. You mostly know when those games are going to be happening. Sunday, maybe sometimes Saturday, but you know that it's going to be on the weekend and you can sort of prepare for it, build around it. I think MLS has to take some steps to ensure that they have eyes on their games and they can kind of pick spots when they know other things aren't going to be happening so they can get more attention. They can make sure that they get fans in the stands, because if you have the Revolution playing a game, they're splitting that stadium with the Patriots. So you have to kind of work around that schedule too. So it is a balancing act, certainly. And I don't think you can just have it be like, we're playing here at this time. That's how it's going to be, especially with how unpredictable the playoffs can be and even just the regular season can be. So I think it's a really interesting question from Richard. We had a lot of really interesting questions this week because I think it's a logical question to ask and it's a logical thing to want. But simultaneously, I think it's a harder thing to execute than I initially thought it would be before I started thinking about this question.
Okay. And why specifically is it hard? Is a hard thing to execute just because of the lack of weekends to get it done?
Yeah, basically. And I think it's also difficult when you have those variables. Like, again, going back to the shared stadiums, Atlanta United has the same thing. Seattle, the same. That you have to kind of, you can't just say, we're doing it here. That's how it's going to be, because there might be a home playoff game or there might be a home game for the Seahawks, let's say. And so you've got to kind of have that balance of, when can we schedule it? We don't know if we're going to be a top seed. We don't know who will be the number one seed, or, oh, the number one seed got knocked off, so now we're hosting a playoff game and we didn't expect to. I think there are those sort of adjustments that have to be made on the fly, and I think they can lead to a more convoluted process. But I think fundamentally, to Richard's question, yes, I think there probably should be that number one seed playing first. I don't think it makes sense to have them wait to play until the final game of that stage. You should probably reward them, or maybe let it be up to them when they want to play first or last, because then, you know, you're rewarding that performance over the season.
Graham, it's been a minute since I watched MLS playoffs from a European time zone, so they're all pretty wild. I'm waking up and some games are finishing and they're all on different kind of days. So your perspective on the organization of the playoffs?
Yeah, when Taylor was talking there about knowing when something is going to happen, that's the big thing for me. And I think there is a lack of a designated, if you want to call it, MLS hour. And I think that's just detrimental to the league's growth as a whole. And this is something that the Premier League does very well. So every weekend, I know when matches are going to be on every weekend in the Premier League. I could even tell you, if you told me that there was a big game, a Man United Liverpool game, I could probably tell you that game's either going to be 5:30 on Saturday UK time or 4 p.m. on Sunday, because that's when those games go on. And I just think, obviously, I know there are geographical issues, and Taylor mentions there rightfully that there's you know, stadium sharing issues like the Yankees NYCFC and Atlanta and so on. But I do feel like MLS has to do a better job of giving itself a slot in the schedule, and that's not just the playoffs either, that's like the regular season I'm talking about as well. And it's so important for leagues to get a slot that is their own. For instance, you know, on a Sunday night, I know there's going to be a big La Liga game on a Sunday night, and I look at how the Colorado Portland game on Thanksgiving, now obviously that is an exceptional case because you can't just play every game on Thanksgiving, and we all know because everyone's at home, that's
can't
why this
we
game
Graham?
Got well, we could, I'd be in favor of that, but that got the, I think, the second highest TV audience in league history, besides Freddie Adu's debut and MLS Cup finals. So that kind of shows you the value of actually picking a time where people can watch these games. And with MLS, like, there's been great growth with MLS in terms of attendances and soccer-specific stadiums and leagues and teams and markets, but it feels like TV is kind of the, or broadcast is the final frontier for the league, and I feel that this is one of the things they need to do, is do a better job of, I call it MLS hour. I think they have to carve out an MLS hour somewhere in the schedule.
MLS hour. It's like magic hours when the sun's just right, Joe. Graham, it sounds beautiful. Joe, I come to you, MLSsoccer.com's Joe Lowry. An impartial take on the playoffs, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's too complicated right now. For me, as someone who's hip deep in this stuff, I know when games are, I know who's playing, I know what's going on. But not everybody is, right? And I'm very aware of that. I think a clearer, simpler, and more regular, more consistent schedule would be great. I don't know if it's... Richard kind of frames this question as this being the next step for MLS to take the next evolution. I don't know that that's true, but I do think that this would be a help. So I do think it would be a part of MLS continuing to evolve. Ryan, you pulled those numbers. I took the exact same approach. It's been between 18 and 23 days this year for the top seeds to play. It's the longest time, but it's been at least 15 days for the top seeds to play a game in the playoffs after decision day in MLS. It's been at least 15 days in each of the last 3 years. It's too long. It's too much of a break. And I know there's complications to it. There's international breaks. There is the stadium sharing, which I think is a great point that you made, Taylor. Five current MLS teams share a stadium with an NFL team in their in-season right now during Major League Soccer's playoffs. It'll be six next year when Charlotte FC joins. So it's not as easy as just saying, yep, this is bad and we need to change it and we can just pencil it in and it'll be all fixed. It's not. And I sympathize with people who have to make these decisions, but it is too long of a gap. It takes momentum away from the season. The playoff schedule itself is inconsistent and weird. Graham, I appreciate how you mentioned the Thanksgiving Day game, because I think that could be an opportunity for MLS to do that over and over again and to start popping into the consciousnesses of people out there. That was not awkwardly phrased at all. But it's going to take time to do this, and Major League Soccer could do very well following the steps of the Premier League or of the National Football League or of La Liga or whatever. It's easier said than done, but little steps along the way. Thanksgiving Day games, maybe shortening that gap between the end of the season and the start of the postseason, things like that would be and are good first steps in this process.
And in terms of fixing the problem of the Revolution waiting too long for their first match as the Supporters Shield winners, is the easiest solution to that not just to limit the number of teams in the playoff?
Yep.
Because that's why they're waiting so long, isn't it? Because there's so many teams in those first round matches, and then obviously you've got the conference semifinals, which you know, you obviously need to have, but it's those first round matches that are delaying everything. So if you make the playoffs smaller in terms of the number of teams, then you fix that problem almost instantly. And in my opinion, you make the playoffs easier to follow. You make them probably more entertaining. You probably raise the stakes a little bit as well and raise the quality. Basically, I'm saying MLS, cut down your playoffs, the number of teams in your playoffs.
Cut down the number of teams in the playoffs. And then also, if you can, just shorten the gap between decision day and the first round. I mean, we didn't have games until the 20th of November, and decision day was, I believe, 12, 13 days before that. So it just doesn't need to be that much of a break. Teams don't need that long, 7-10 days max. That's kind of the figure that Jordan was giving on our show yesterday. That's a good window, but anything beyond that, and I think you start to lose eyes and you start to lose people's attention and their desire to watch the games at all.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it there, Joe. It is that gap between Dishes and Day in the first round games, because it could be 1 week. It doesn't need to be two. Joe, it does seem like the Thanksgiving game was a success. We were told that, I think, 5 billion people watched it, but it's gone down to about 1.6 million have watched it, with those figures being revised. Could there be a world where MLS Cup final is on Thanksgiving Day? It can't happen next year because obviously the World Cup is taking place during that time. But would that be a good idea? You know, expedite the playoffs a little bit so you have your showpiece game on a day where virtually everybody's got the day off that could be watching it.
It's not bad, Ryan. I hadn't thought about that before. It's not bad. And it does sort of line up timing-wise with what I believe MLS kind of wants their schedule to be. So next season, you mentioned this can't happen because of the World Cup, and you're right. But MLS is starting their season on February 26th in 2022, and they have MLS Cup down for November 5th. So you extend the offseason a little bit. I know Major League Soccer is generally trying to tighten up that offseason and provide more competition in season, and League's Cup is going to be a part of that. So there's some other factors here. But yeah, ending the season on Thanksgiving, on whatever date that Thursday is each year, it would give people a date on the calendar to say, yeah, I know this game is on this day. It's like with the Super Bowl. I always know it's going to be the first Sunday in February, and that's really helpful to have in the back of my head. And I think MLS would be doing themselves a favor by establishing some sort of continuity from year to year.
I like the idea of the continuity. I just have to say, as a person who occasionally goes to MLS Cup, I don't want it to be on Thanksgiving. I think probably a lot of journalists would not love if they had to be away from their families to cover MLS
Christmas
Cup.
Day, then.
Maybe that's a minor thing. What'd you say, Graham?
Christmas Day, then.
Oh, perfect. That's better. Let's just make it Christmas Day. No, I mean, that's a minor complaint, but I think that's maybe a personal one. But yeah, for me, I think they would worry about the conflict of a holiday and scheduling it on that holiday and trying to steal Thanksgiving's thunder. How dare you, MLS?
Yeah, it doesn't stop people going to garbage Detroit Lions games, though, Taylor, to be fair.
Yeah, but that's because it's a tradition, Ryan. The Lions are terrible on Thanksgiving. We all know this.
Something tells me that Don Garber doesn't really care too much about stealing Thanksgiving's thunder as well, but I don't know. Could be wrong.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. We go now to Robert Cordova's question. Which clubs would be at a disadvantage with players taking part in the 2022 Africa Cup of Nations, the 33rd AFCON taking place from January 9th to February 6th, coming up in a matter of weeks in Cameroon? It's the first one since 2019. It's usually biennial. Graham, looks like around 15 Premier League clubs are going to be affected, up to 40 Premier League players. But which club, Premier League or otherwise, is going to be at the biggest disadvantage, asks Robert.
Yeah, so I went through all the Premier League clubs primarily to see which players would be missing for AFCON at the start of next year. As you say, I think maybe the one that's most obvious would be Liverpool. There's already been a lot of chat around Liverpool because obviously two of their fabled famous front three are likely to be away for AFCON. So that's Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane. And then you also have Naby Keita as well, who is maybe not so much of a loss. Liverpool do have a lot of options in midfield, but certainly losing Salah and Mane could impact their title challenge quite significantly, you would say. And then another one that further down the table that I would mention is Watford.
Yeah.
So Ismail Assar, who is, I would say, their best player, he might not be around. I would suggest that Watford for more than this season, so losing him for any period is a big blow. And then Emmanuel Dennis as well, who's probably their best forward in great form for at the moment as well. And then Peter Etebo as well for them. So obviously the stakes for Watford are really high in that they are in a relegation battle. If you're losing players as a mid-table team, you know, like Arsenal or someone, then you are maybe not. It's not going to be such an impact on your season, but for Watford, it could be the difference between them staying up or going down.
That's a big hit for Watford. I do just want to add, Ismail Assar is injured currently. He picked up a knee injury against Manchester United, so we don't really know his availability. The Athletic reported, and just, I guess, recycled this information, that Assar will be out likely around a month, which would make it challenging for him to go. We don't really know what's up there, but either way, playing without Assar is no bueno for Watford.
No bueno indeed. Watford with potentially six players out, including Sar, it seems, Graham. I wonder, there are clubs who are affected, like Liverpool, quite prominently, but Watford is a very good example. What about Crystal Palace, who have Cheka Coyote, Jordan Ayew, Jeffrey Schlupp, and Wilfried Zaha, all potentially or most likely going? Taylor, what do you think of that? For me, pound for pound, they might be the most affected team.
Yeah, I think I agree with Graham. I think Liverpool is probably the one that could suffer the most ill effect because of two of those players from that front line being gone. But Crystal Palace was the other one that came right to mind, because the players you mentioned likely to go, but also are players that have played so consistently for Crystal Palace this season. Jordan Ayew has played in 13 of 14 Premier League games, Koyate 12 of 14, Schlupp 10 of 14, Zaha 13 of 14. That's a lot of starts to be missing for a club like Crystal Palace, who don't have a ton of money and obviously won't be able to kind of go out and free spend to bring in temporary replacements. So how they kind of bridge that gap is going to be a challenge. Then there's other sort of like Leicester will be missing four players, but I'm sure Leicester can find a way to make it through and be just fine. Chelsea would be the other one, just because Mendy's going to be gone, and when you're missing your starting goalkeeper, that can be an issue, especially when they haven't always trusted the people behind Mendy in goal.
I was going to say, especially when your second choice is Kepa.
Yeah. And then they were also missing Hakim Ziyech as well from Morocco, but they have plenty of attacking talent, but missing their goalkeeper, the starting goalkeeper at that, could be a problem, because I also think Senegal are likely to go deep. I have a feeling Egypt and Senegal will both go deep, which means Liverpool might be without Salah and Mane that much longer.
And I guess we should probably mention, even though Manchester City have, they're probably the best equipped to handle the loss of a key player, but nonetheless, Riyad Mahrez as well. He's, I think he flies under the radar as one of City's most important players, so they might feel that a little bit, although as I say, they do have more options than any other team in the league, so they might survive.
Joe, any teams have missed out? Maybe Arsenal's worth discussing. Thomas Partey potentially missing out. Pepe, El Nene. I mean, Aubameyang's not scoring for them now, so maybe he could be not scoring for them in January as well.
Yeah, Arsenal's on my list for sure. And they've got games during this period, during AFCON, against Man City, against Tottenham, Burnley, and Wolves. And a lot of those are key games based off of where they are in the table and where those teams I just mentioned are in the table in terms of keeping their spot towards the top of the Premier League. Arsenal's a good shout, Ryan. Another one that I wanted to mention is Burnley, with Maxwell Cornet potentially being called up to the Ivory Coast. Burnley aren't going to be missing a ton of players in terms of quantity, but quality-wise, Cornet is their leading scorer, and they're fighting to get out of the relegation zone. They're in 18th right now in the league, which is that third to bottom spot. So they're in the relegation zone right now as a recording. Losing your leading goal scorer for a month-ish or a little bit less, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it's going to be, that's not ideal. So I looked at Burnley, and then to go along the line of reasoning that Taylor was using, looking at teams that might go deep, Senegal and Morocco are two that I have in mind. So we already talked about Liverpool potentially being without Sadio Mane for a while. Napoli could be without Koulibaly, and that's a big blow for them. He's already dealing with a little knock, but he should be back in time to be called up by that team. We already mentioned Mendy and Chelsea too. And then with Morocco, a non-Premier League team, we haven't really gotten outside of the Premier League, but Sevilla could be without Bono, their goalkeeper, and then Youssef En-Nesyri, who's a forward for them too. Two players that are relatively important to that team, and we all just watched them over the weekend, and we saw a lot of these components playing under Lopetegui. So that's a team outside of the Premier League that could be dealing with some cracks that need to be papered over for about a month or so.
Yeah, Joe, with Napoli as well, you mentioned Koulibaly, but there's also Anguissa, there's Osimhen, there is Goulem, and there's another Algerian, Unas. So they're going to be missing five players potentially in that Napoli team that, again, don't have a ton of depth, and especially when we're talking about a player like Koulibaly, who is one of their captains, but is also just such a like rock at the back for them.
Yeah.
What they're able to do in his absence, Anguissa has been important for them this season. Obviously, Osimhen scores goals, leads that line, has the speed that terrifies defenses. So I think Napoli could also be in for a rough couple of weeks.
Indeed. This edition of AFCON, by the way, was originally scheduled for June and July 2021, last summer, but unfavorable weather conditions moved it back to January. Pushed to this January, so it's gone back onto its winter schedule, where other they toyed with having it in the summer for a little while. But there's going to be plenty of teams who are without key players after the festive period. Robert, thank you very much for your question. We'll be back with much more after these messages.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we are back with your listener questions. Here comes one from Sagar Sriramajiri. While it's very common for coaches or managers to be fired quite often, why don't players get fired in the same way? Don't the clubs still pay out the manager when they fire them ahead of contract? Why not do the same with players, asks Sagar. It seems to me, Taylor, historically footballers or soccer players only usually get fired for disciplinary issues or when they go to prison. So it's a good question for Sagar. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it is a really good question. I wanted to ask first to you all, am I correct in saying that this is not exclusive to soccer? Like, I think most sports would prefer to fire their coach before they're firing their like star player or a couple of their star players. Am I correct in saying that, or do you think it's different in other sports?
I think the mechanisms of soccer make that the case, certainly, Taylor. I think the big two points for me are that a manager is the easiest piece of the puzzle to move out when you're trying to make a wholesale change rather than one player on an entire team. And I think a big economic part of it is you can sell players, but you can't sell managers. So it's more troublesome to move on players for a hit when you can take the hit on the manager because you're not going to sell them.
And I think a lot of other sports, the same thing applies. Like, I don't think you see players getting removed and coaches staying on terribly often. You could see them getting traded or not having their contracts renewed, but you don't really see them dismissed in the way that you see coaches dismissed.
Thanks, because I wanted to answer this one as best I could, but I think that does trip me up a little bit, because I think there are certain mechanisms that make it more likely for a manager to be sacked instead of a player. But it does seem like fundamentally, if you've got a group of however many players on a roster, it's easier if they're maybe underperforming or if a few of them don't seem happy to get rid of the manager and hope that a new manager, a new personality changes things or creates a spark that gets something going. So I think that does happen kind of across the board in sports. But then I think there are certain structures in place in soccer and football that make it more likely for the manager to go, specifically being transfer windows, that if you are going to get rid of a player who is underperforming, you only have certain windows when you can register new players. Whereas with managers, as far as I understand, no such regulation. You can sack and hire managers as much as you want. And in Italy, sometimes that happens like six times a season. Valencia, I think, had 5 in 1 season or 4 in 1 season. So I think it basically, you do have some structures in place. I think the other aspect would be that weirdly, it seems like it is more acceptable in the footballing world for a front office person to get the manager wrong, but not the star acquisition. And I think there's a strange amount of pride wrapped up in not being the one who brought in a flop. And somehow it's more acceptable, I think, for managers to be a flop, and you can kind of put that on them. Jose Mourinho is this temperamental, cantankerous person that no one could have ever known was going to be that way, except everyone could have definitely known that. It's just sort of you can dismiss it a bit once you don't need to defend that person. Whereas with a player, I think there's a vested interest in not showing your cards, not tipping your hand and saying, yeah, this isn't really working, we want to get rid of this player, because then you have also sort of shot yourself in the foot when it comes to resale value. So I think there's an element of pride when it comes to players. I think there's certainly financial ramifications as well. And then I think there are squad limitations that make it more likely for the manager to go.
And the thing I was going to mention about this question, the question poses why not do the same with players. It isn't common for this to happen, but clubs will actually do this. It's just maybe not in the same way that they'll do it with a manager. So obviously when a manager gets paid off, they're getting paid essentially not to work. But if you look at an example I thought of was Wayne Rooney, for example. When he left Manchester United and went to Everton, Manchester United were paying, it was either 50% or close to 50% of his salary to play for Everton. So in a sense, they were paying up his contract for him to leave Manchester United. It was just that he was going to another club, and for the duration of the time that he was at that other club, Manchester United were essentially handing him a wage. I think Man United did the same with Alexis Sanchez as well, where they were paying a good portion of his wage to go on loan, in that case, to Inter Milan.
Good
so
business.
I guess that the loan mechanism is slightly different with Sanchez. But then what happened for Sanchez to go permanently to Inter Milan, I believe, and I found some reports on this, that Man United paid up a certain amount of his contract. And when that happens, it tends to be to appease a player who maybe isn't so keen to leave, and someone who's going on big wages to lower wages at another club, which would have been the case for Sanchez going from Manchester United, where he was earning like $5 billion a week, to Inter Milan, who weren't paying him that much. So he got a portion of his Manchester United contract paid up for him to go to Inter Milan. So it does happen with players. It's just maybe not as common as with managers.
Joe, could this be there could be a reputational aspect of this as well. If a player were to be sacked, it'll be harder for them to carry on with their careers. Whereas a manager, it's pretty acceptable that you are fired and you get a great job thereafter.
For me, it comes down to value. Well, it comes down to visual, Ryan, which I think you mentioned earlier, right? It's easier to look like you're addressing a problem when you fire a coach than when you fire a player. Again, that doesn't happen all that often. So it looks like, oh, we're being proactive, we're trying to fix this, when in reality, a manager's impact is generally overstated anyway. So there's the visuals aspect of it. And then I think there's value. Players have value on the market in a way that coaches don't, really. I mean, maybe a few coaches do. There's exceptions to this. But generally speaking, players can be turned into money in a way that coaches cannot be turned into money. Even players who are less, even a player who you think of as being not even all that important compared to a coach who you would think is being pretty important. There's still a gulf in a lot of situations in the value between those two people, with the player having more value and able to be transferred into cash for a club. I think that really, to get to Sagar's question, I think that really is the single biggest factor here, because of how soccer works and how the transfer market works and how we attribute value to different parts of sport, and with players being the most important part. You can't have a game if you don't have players. I think that is the biggest factor at play here.
Sagar, thank you very much for that question. A very interesting one indeed. By the way, while I was researching this, I kind of looked into players who have been sacked. And it does, as I say, tend to be disciplinary issues. I think the most interesting one, Graham, I don't know if you remember Adrian Mutu at Chelsea. He was relieved of duties in 2004 when he tested positive for naughty drugs. Not only was he fired, he had to pay, FIFA ruled that he had to pay Chelsea over £15 million in compensation for breaching the terms of his contract. And he went through many legal wrangles to try and get out of that fine, and he didn't. I think he still is either on the hook for it or he's had to pay it. Crazy.
Yeah, that there can't be many cases like that, I'd imagine. That seems, given the precedent across the board, that seems a little harsh to me anyway. But yeah, that's a sore one.
It was sore indeed, and maybe, not so fun times for Adrian Mutu or Chelsea in that instance. Sagar, thank you for the question. We move on to Jackie Choi. Which domestic leagues or club teams do you think will benefit the most from the World Cup being in the middle of the season, and which clubs do you think will suffer? For example, says Jackie, will a middling Premier League team have more success next season because all Man City's players were at the World Cup and didn't get the rest that, say, Southampton's roster might get? Taylor, I come to you. It does seem a lot of Premier League teams, perhaps most Premier League teams, will be impacted by the World Cup this year.
Yeah, I think a lot of clubs around the world will be. I think I looked at it from a league perspective, and weirdly, I think Major League Soccer might be one of the leagues that is up the most to benefit from it, because the league runs through the summer. You usually have a World Cup in there that does take some players away, but it certainly takes eyes away. And I think when you don't have the World Cup, when you don't have other international competitions, like maybe leagues will start earlier, but I think there will be a chunk of time when Major League Soccer can sort of dominate the marketplace. If you're looking for live soccer, especially here in this country, I think you'll get more people tuning into MLS because there's not much else to watch when it comes to soccer at that point. And that is, like, that was the reason, one of the main reasons why they wanted to get MLS's back underway so quickly, is because they knew that they had sort of a captive audience who wanted to watch something, so we can make that happen. And I think MLS could benefit from it in this case. I think the Bundesliga is going to be largely unaffected because they already have that lengthy winter break, and I think they can adjust it to start a little bit earlier and maybe finish a little bit earlier, and so then you can sort of have a gap that you would have had anyway. You could allow for a little bit of time to recover, and then the league resumes, and I think that they will be mostly okay, barring the obvious injury concerns and things like that. I have a larger answer to this as well, but I've talked plenty already, so I will turn it over to everyone else, and then maybe we'll come back to me. We'll see.
Yeah,
I think if you're looking at the leagues, sorry, Ryan, I think if you're looking at the leagues, undoubtedly the league that's going to be impacted the most, I think, is the Premier League. In terms of the Big Five, anyway, Scotland as well will be impacted to a certain extent, because obviously we're not getting as many players called up, but the Premier League, any league in Europe that has a winter break, even a short one, so Spain has a short mm-hmm. winter break of 2 weeks, not as long as the Bundesliga, that's going to mitigate the blow of having the World Cup in the middle of the season. The Premier League does not have a winter break, and in fact actually ramps up the games around the festive period, which I have to admit I am a fan of. I would be disappointed to see that go. I'm a bit of a Luddite in that respect. I like my Boxing Day football. But in this case, it's going to be a big problem for the Premier League. I think it's 8 days between the World Cup final and the resumption of the Premier League season,
yep.
which is absolutely wild.
So maybe in that respect, Graham, is it best, is it most beneficial for teams with players of nations who are going to go home after 3 games? So they get to go and have the experience, the confidence of playing in a World Cup, but they still get at least a few weeks rest and, you know, combined with the match practice that they'll get in the World Cup. Is that the best compromise possibly?
I guess, because obviously those players that are still going to the World Cup are going to be high quality players, but you're still getting them back after the first stage of the tournament. So yeah, I could see the logic in that. I went through a lot of the teams in the Premier League in particular, because as I say, I think that is going to be the league that's impacted the most. So I think the reflex reaction is to think that the best teams will be hit the hardest by the World Cup, because obviously they'll have the most players called up to national teams. However, you could also argue they've got the most depth, and so they'll be best equipped. Then you have teams near the bottom of the Premier League who might not have many players called up at all, and they should be okay. And I think it's the teams in between those two extremes that could find themselves in a bit of trouble. So the first club that sprung to mind for me, I just looked through some of their players, through their squad, was Aston Villa. So they would lose Emi Martinez, who obviously Argentina, Emi Buendia as well, who's been in that squad recently, so Argentina probably going far in that tournament. Ollie Watkins has been part of the England squad recently as well, Tyrone Mings, and then you've also got, hopefully, John McGinn. I'm just manifesting this into existence sure. now with John McGinn, but Matty Cash as well, I think he's playing for Poland as well now. So who's replacing those players for them, because that's the kind of club they have players that are good enough to go to the World Cup, but they don't have the depth to kind of replace them. So it's those kind of teams that I think might struggle the most.
Yes, it's the same conundrum as AFCON. It's your Crystal Palaces yeah. and your Watfords and your Aston Villas who might actually suffer those middle teams, which Jackie referred to. Taylor, I'm going to take a slightly different approach with your when you posited that Bundesliga teams might be benefiting or unaffected, because you know, Bayern Munich players are used to going and chilling for Qatar every winter anyway. It's what they do in their winter break. But when they are used to a winter break, and you have a lot of German players who are in reality going to go deep in this tournament, in previous times when they've been used to having a few weeks off to put their feet up, and they're going to be going deep in a tournament in Asia instead, does that not work against them somewhat?
I mean, just in the sense that they have, like, more games to play, yeah, certainly. But I think they also have then the summer to have a longer break. And I think also you'll still get a lot of teams that do have that break because they don't have players going. And so you'll have players still training probably in warm weather climates, and people who are left off squads or people whose teams don't qualify will still have that sort of that time together. So I think really it just comes down to who gets injured, because we know there's going to be injuries coming out of the World Cup. And I think that's the biggest thing. I think that sort of is my answer, is that there's more likely to me, and I don't think this is a cop-out answer because I genuinely mean it, but like, I think it's just going to be a lot of little ramifications that we won't know about until maybe like a year after the tournament. I picture a lot of think pieces about how this little decision led to this entire gigantic decision. For example, so often if a club needs a new manager, they will wait until after the World Cup, because maybe a potential candidate is coaching at the World Cup. Or maybe somebody, like, there's a hot hand, like, oh, this guy's doing this really interesting thing, let's get him in. That can happen. When you have the World Cup in the fall, then maybe you have a club who's less inclined to go after a manager. Maybe they don't sack a manager they would have sacked otherwise. Maybe they hold on to that manager but don't really want to back him, so they don't invest. And you might have more like clubs more likely to get relegated because they're holding off on bringing in a new manager or sacking their current one. You might have players not be on the move because sometimes with a World Cup, you get those sort of jacked up fees because one player, James Rodriguez, had a really good tournament and suddenly he is going for six times what he probably would have before the World Cup. So you might have permutations in the transfer market we don't know yet, both positive and negative. And I think that is going to be the most interesting thing to me, is just how much everything is going to have to be adjusted and how seamlessly that can happen. And I think in some ways it will be seamless, and in other ways it will be very much the opposite of that.
Joe, your thoughts on this question. What about teams with French players on them? They're due a mutiny. That could have a negative effect when they come back in January.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, I am excited for another 12,000-word Athletic article about the drama inside of France, France's national men's team. I think that would be great fun. I pretty much agree with everything that's been said already. I think Graham especially hit the nail on the head. There's a reality where the big clubs will be losing a lot of players, but they have the depth to absorb at least some of that in a way that maybe the middle tier teams in some of these leagues just don't. And so I think those teams could actually be at the biggest disadvantage. But I'm not covering any new ground there. I think the teams at the bottom will still likely be the teams at the bottom. Ultimately, I think the teams at the top will still stay there by and large. And it will be the middle tier teams that have the most difficulty trying to figure out how to adapt without some of the pieces of their squad.
Thank you very much, Joseph. Thank you, Jackie. We'll be back shortly with a few more listener questions.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we've got some listener questions. Here's one from Shreyas Romani. Hey Shreyas, how's it going? He's got a two-parter. Oh, part boy. One, what are some of the most notable or your favorite soccer matches played in bad weather? Part two, why don't more soccer teams have stadiums that are covered or with retractable roofs? Joe, I come to you first. I have a feeling there's maybe a USMNT snow game you might put on your list.
You dog. Yes, that is far and away number one on my list. Both of the games on my list actually come from the same stadium, and that's Dick's Sporting Goods Park in Colorado. It's where the Colorado Rapids play. The Snow Classico has got to be number one. It was snowing, you guys. The field was white and the ball was hard to see. It felt like we were watching a very, 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 very tame version of that game over the weekend when we watched Man City and what was that? Man City and West Ham? That's what it was, right?
Yep.
Man City, West Ham? That's got to be number one for me. The U.S. winning that game in World Cup qualifying. Clint Dempsey gets the goal in the first half. It was a snow fight. I think that's how some folks from Costa Rica put it after the first 15 minutes of this one. It's a wild thing that a soccer game took place there. Costa Rica appealed. FIFA denied the appeal, and the result stood. So that's number one far and away for me. Number two, a little bit less well-known. A CCL game happened in that same stadium, Dick's Sporting Goods Park, in 2018 between Toronto and the Colorado Rapids. It was 3 degrees, fellas. It was 3 degrees in that stadium at that time. I cannot fathom playing soccer in 3 degree weather, and I'm glad that I did not have to, and that I'm instead sitting inside of a climate controlled room
that's
talking to you all.
Weather.
Yeah, that's a positively beautiful summer day, 3 degrees Fahrenheit in Glasgow, right, Graham?
Yeah, I was going to say, being a Scottish football fan, pretty much all matches are played in bad weather. So I've got a number to mention.
Go ahead, Graham.
I was actually just going to use it as an excuse to tell a personal tale about a game that I went to personally. So I once travelled up to Arbroath for a Stirling Albion game on Boxing Day, funnily enough, which I've already said is my favourite football day in the year. And Arbroath isn't exactly close to where I live, and Arbroath Stadium is right on the North Sea. And when I say that, I mean it is the wall behind one of the stands literally backs onto the sea. So when you kick a ball over the stand, it goes into the sea. That's how close it is. And the wind that day was so bad that the goalkeepers couldn't get a goal kick beyond the edge of their box, quite literally. Couldn't get it beyond the edge of their box. The ball was blowing straight back to the goalkeepers, and it resulted in this bizarre situation I've never seen anywhere else in any other game, where every outfield player was lining up on the edge of the box as the goalkeeper was kicking it out, because the ball was blowing back into the box and there was a chance that they could then run into the box. And this is when you couldn't play a goal kick into the box. So they're all lined up on the edge of the box. And as soon as the goalkeeper hit it, they were all then standing in the box, hoping to get like a header or something in the box. It was absolutely bizarre. And the match was abandoned after 10 minutes. But those 10 minutes were very fun. And even though I didn't get to watch a match on Boxing Day and it was way up north, and I spent a lot of time travelling up there, it was kind of worth it because I got a good story out of it. And I remember that game more than most games that were played to 90 minutes.
Were you wearing your kilt that day, Graham? Was it pretty chilly down there?
I mean, I wear my kilt most days. Do you not?
Do you wear it like a true Scotsman?
No comment.
There is a temptation, Graham, to go for games that have snow on them, but there are a few windy and wet games we should mention. When I did the Dirty Tackle blog, there was a number of sort of obscure games that I covered, and I dug up some of those. For example, there was a friendly match between Dynamo Kiev and Asif Mendes. I don't even know where they're from, full disclosure. But there's an own goal where the goalkeeper takes a goal kick. It goes up in the air about 30 feet. And then go straight back into the goal. The wind is so strong against him. And there was another one I found from the blog in 2013. There was a Kazakhstani league match where the pitch was so waterlogged that they put the ball down for a corner by the corner flag, and it just floats away. It just starts floating away on the puddles. Taylor, what do you got?
The snow throw game is certainly on that list for me. Another one that I've mentioned previously is MLS Cup 1996. I'm sending you all the group. I will like try to post this later. This is the photo that I always think of with that MLS Cup game. But it's Richie Williams trying to make a play on Kobe Jones. It's a close-up of them, and you can see just how much water there is on that pitch, because it started raining, it continued raining, and then it rained even more as the game went on. And so it just became this like slog, but in the best possible way, of like when you'd get the ball bouncing in unpredictable ways and just sitting up in a puddle all of a sudden. And so it kind of made that game even more unpredictable than it already was. And as a DC fan, I enjoyed the win there. So I think that one looms pretty large for me. And then the other one that like I was not there for, I did not cover, but I think, like, as Graham was as demonstrating, when there are stories behind it, then I think it tends to be this bigger thing, this thing that kind of is preserved in the memory. And 2013 MLS Cup seems to be that for the very least most media people that I've talked to about that game. Anyone who was there has a story, because it was, I believe they had all of the press outside. It was 20 degrees at kickoff, and I think with the wind chill, much felt like much colder than that, and then it got much colder than that. It's the longest MLS Cup game in history. It went 10 rounds in the shootout, with Sporting KC eventually winning 7-6. But even when I was at the USA-Mexico game, there was a person there talking about how people's laptops froze or stopped working because they got so cold that they wouldn't function anymore, that people kept trying to bundle up and having to like go for walks and were missing parts of the game and had to cover for each other. So like just how cold it was for the people in the stadium, I think made that game somewhat more of a spectacle, or at least more like prominent in my memory than maybe the result would have been otherwise.
Wonderful. Just looking at that picture you sent, Taylor, which I hope you post later, of that 96 MLS Cup final, the baggy 90s yep. kits, they look yep. like they're so heavy and they carry so much water on them as well.
And their shoes, too. Their shoes look, the socks, everything looks like it has like an extra maybe 15 pounds of weight on it because of the rain.
Just like me after Thanksgiving, extra 15 pounds of weight. Boom, boom. There was another game I wanted to point out in December 2017 in the Bundesliga, one I came across in my research. It was Cologne 3, Freiburg 4. It was a relegation six-pointer, this game, effectively. Cologne went 3-0 up in this one, and they lost 4-3. An absolutely wild game in which there was very, very heavy snow. The opening goal for Cologne, the referee couldn't actually find the penalty spot, so he had to go to the goal line and march out 12 yards and sort of mark it and say, put the ball there. So, and by the way, Graham, they had a real orange ball that probably cost less than $100 they were using in that game as well. And Cologne, who I say lost that game 4-3 to Freiburg, Cologne went down that season and Freiburg survived by 3 points. So it was a pretty crucial game in the end. And another thing I learned today is that the first match in World Cup history was on July 13th, 1930 in Uruguay. France beat Mexico 4-1. It was snowing in that game because it was winter, of course, in the Southern Hemisphere. I didn't catch any footage of that. Not sure that they had cameras at that one, but I'll take the word for the report that I read on that one. The second part of the question here from Shreyas was about stadiums with roofs and why there is not more of a propensity for them. The more famous stadiums I can think of, certainly in Europe, which do have roofs, the Johan Cruyff Arena, formerly the Amsterdam Arena, which was the first major European stadium with a roof. The Veltins Arena at Schalke, they can close the roof when they want to. And Parken, also, FC Copenhagen's home, which was used at Euro 2020, they can close that one up too. And my understanding is that the new Bernabeu should have a roof as well, Graham. It looks very fancy, doesn't it?
It does, and I'm really looking forward to that stadium going being built. Sorry, it's the best big stadium I've ever been to, the Bernabeu, and so the thought that they're improving it further is quite something. But I think to answer the question of why soccer teams don't have retractable roofs, or why more teams don't have them, it's surely got to be cost, right? Because it's so expensive to have to build a retractable roof. So I couldn't find a breakdown of the Bernabeu project, but that renovation, and it's not even a complete new rebuild, it's a renovation, that's going to cost close to £700 million, which is the best part of $1 billion. And obviously that is the whole project, but I'd imagine a large chunk of that will be the roof. I was looking at some other sports and the costs of roofs on stadiums. So tennis, there's a number of retractable roofs in tennis. And they are much smaller arenas as well than a soccer stadium. So when they put a retractable roof on Arthur Ashe Stadium at Flushing Meadows, it cost $150 million. The centre court roof at Wimbledon cost £100 million. And as I say, that's a much smaller arena than a soccer stadium. So I can imagine putting a retractable roof on a soccer stadium costs quite a bit.
In addition to cost, Graham, is there not more? Is there also a question of logistics and the culture of the game? It's a game that's supposed to be played out in the open.
Yeah.
And in terms of the logistics, when you've got a grass field, you kind of need to have some sunshine on it occasionally.
Exactly, and you see that even in stadiums that have just roofs over the stands, you even see clubs building their new stadiums in a way that the pitch can be taken out and almost put in the direct sunlight. I think they do that looking at an NFL stadium. I saw Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas has a mechanism to take the field outdoors so that it gets sunlight and it gets water and things. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I'd imagine that would be a logistical problem with the field. And also, as you say, it's just not part of soccer's culture. You can play, for instance, in tennis, they have retractable roofs at every major stadium in the Grand Slams because you can't play tennis in the rain. You can play soccer in the rain, and it would only really be a deluge that would stop you from playing. So you'd only really need it once every few years, really, to stop a game from being postponed. Yeah. It's a bit of an extravagance.
Yeah. Taylor, I was looking at World Cup stadiums for 2022. There's only one of the eight stadiums that has a roof. The Al Bayt Stadium is going to have a retractable roof. It may already do so, in fact. That kind of surprised me because, given the climate, why would they not have roofs and climate cool the stadium a bit better?
I'm not sure. My guess would be that because I think part of the plan was to build the stadiums more or less underground or build them into the ground. So I think there's probably a built-in cooling mechanism already. I also would venture to guess that there is a cost-saving measure in place because you have to spend more to have that retractable roof. You have to have the facilities, or you likely have to have the facilities, as Graham mentioned, to move the pitch, and all of those things cost money. So every time you're opening the roof or closing the roof or moving the pitch, you are having to spend money. It costs money to move those things, to do those procedures. And I read an interview with a German club director, I forget which one it was basically asked like why they didn't have a retractable roof. And his response was in like, definitive fashion, that's just another thing that can break, and then you have to try to, like, you have to maintain it, you have to fix it. It's just, I think, increased costs. And so I think for Qatar there was probably a, we'll hang screens over and we'll provide shade that way, we'll build it in. The stadiums, I believe, are all going to be air conditioned or will have pretty prominent air conditioning, so I'm guessing they think they've taken enough precautionary measures to not need those retractable roofs.
Did that not happen with the Millennium Stadium? I haven't researched this, so I don't have any solid information, but I'm sure I saw a report that for a period of time they had the roof closed, and they said it was just because that was the choice that they had made for a certain number of games, but actually it was because the roof wasn't working properly. And so they just said, yeah, we're keeping it closed for now because that's what we want to do, but it's because they literally couldn't get it open.
Yeah, because as soon as you've spent millions and millions and millions of dollars or pounds or whatever it might be on this thing, you don't then want to own, like, oh yeah, it's not working again. It can make you look foolish. It can make you look like you don't know what you're doing, or you hired faulty contractors, and anything that makes executives look bad, they don't want to be publicly known. So I think, yeah, that makes sense.
I went to that stadium once to see Oasis and Foo Fighters play a joint show, and they had the roof closed and it was still freezing. Joe, I learned something a couple of weeks ago I should mention here. I went to the Colosseum here in Rome, and I learned that they had a roof on the Colosseum. It was actually lots of sections of canvas, which they would pull over manually with like pulleys and levers, basically.
BC Place.
Yeah, and it was basically part of the spectacle of the day to say, oh, look how fancy and rich this empire is. We can put a roof on our stadium here. And as far as I know, Joe, it went really well for the Roman Empire. They're still going, I think.
I was
going
to say, if the ancient Romans did it, why aren't we doing it? Everything was good there, right? There weren't any like major issues or collapses or,
I wonder who was pulling those pulleys as well in ancient Rome, because I'm going to guess they weren't doing it voluntarily.
Taylor,
so
don't kill the vibe.
That might also been part of it.
Taylor, don't kill the vibe.
Ryan, did they, all right, I'll take it this way. Ryan, did they also blow your mind when they mentioned that they used to hold mock naval battles in the Colosseum?
Oh, I didn't get to that bit. What happened there?
They would flood the like the center part of it, and then they would have like they would stage mock battles for like so the citizens could see what had happened and in like a famous battle or a famous war. So yeah, I think it had lots of multifaceted features, that Colosseum.
Yeah, when my children were saying, Daddy, what did they do in this Colosseum? And I was like, maybe I'll tell you when you're older what they actually did
with
the animals
Crow
and such.
Russell Crowe was a general. Just start with that, and I think that's all they need to know.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question there, Shreyas. One more for you today from Michael Hastings Black. I like this question. What are some of the most famous, in brackets, unproven conspiracy theories in soccer? I've got the TSS lawyers fire truck on hold for this one, gents, so let's be careful. This is a different question to curses, which we've covered, I think, before with, you know, the Bela Gutman curse and so on. This is conspiracy theories. Graham, the one that springs to mind immediately here for me is Ronaldo at France 98, the original R9 Ronaldo, who had a seizure in the dressing room before the final. He was on the team sheet, and then I remember watching the game on the coverage, and they said, well, his name's been taken off the team sheet. There's a lot of confusion that day, and he got put back on the team sheet. And the conspiracy, Graham, was that either Nike had forced him to play the game, or that Brazil had bribed some there's some weird FIFA stuff going on there to get the tournament in 2006, which they didn't. Yeah, that was the one that stood out to me.
Yeah, exactly. That's top of my list as well. Edmundo, who was a teammate of Ronaldo in that squad, he's been quoted in interviews saying that Nike pressured Brazil to play him when he shouldn't have been playing. The thing that I think we can all agree that there's something, he wasn't physically right that day. You can see it in his performance. He'd been the billboard star of that World Cup. He'd been the player of the tournament up until that point. And in the final, he was lethargic in the game and played well within himself. So I don't think there's much sort of mystery over the fact that something happened to him physically. It's just what happened to him as the conspiracy theory. There's theories that he had a reaction to some form of painkilling injection. He had a seizure. I think Edmundo says that in the interview, he saw him have a fit. So yeah, that's one of the biggest mysteries in world football. I would really like to know, just because it's lingered for so long now, you know, it's like, what is it, 23 years or something like that? I would like to know what happened one day, but I'm not convinced we'll ever find out.
Yeah, Mr. Nike might not let you ever know that, Graham. So maybe the mystery will remain. Taylor, another favourite of mine is Lasagna Gate. This was 2005, 2006, Tottenham playing West Ham on the last day of the season. If Tottenham won that game, they would have overtaken Arsenal into fourth place and nabbed their fourth place trophy, their Champions League spot. But most of the Tottenham team got food poisoning from their hotel, from a lasagna that night, which may or may not have been concocted by Arsene Wenger. Arsenal were staying nearby. They were playing Wigan and they won their game. So that one is that one goes down in Premier League lore, Taylor.
I like that one quite a bit. Oh, man. All right. I forgot about that one. I focused on some that are sort of known, but just like not fully proven, like the disgrace of Gijon, the game between Austria and Germany, where they definitely conspired to, they both needed a draw, I think, and then they would both advance, or Germany could win 1-0, and then they would both advance, and that's exactly how it played out. And everybody could tell that they had both kind of agreed beforehand, but FIFA came out and said no one broke any rules. The result stood. But that one is definitely discussed as definitely being a version of match fixing, even if no one has ever said it did happen. Similarly, you will find lots of reports about when Argentina hosted and won the World Cup, about doping and irregular medical tests and players testing positive for being pregnant and weird blood tests that might have happened. And so I think there's a lot of speculation that maybe the influence of the military junta also playing a part in Argentina eventually winning that World Cup. And then one that I've always sort of heard, never read a ton about, but felt appropriate to include here, would be the 1986 World Cup moving to Mexico instead of the original host country of Colombia. I think I also remember there being stories about a previous earthquake that had still caused problems to infrastructure and they hadn't been able to repair the results of that disaster. But the conspiracy that I have long heard and do believe is that a lot of it related to the drug war that was ongoing in Colombia and the violence and conflict there. They couldn't guarantee stability, but it would have been a very bad look to say, such is the instability in the country that we can't host a World Cup. So they went a different route with it. I don't know how much I believe that, but it's one that I sort of hear widely whispered as factual without it ever being like definitively proven or stated.
Yeah, and on that same vein, Taylor, the 1990 World Cup, also involving Argentina, the water bottle spiking. Branco, the Brazilian defender, claimed that there was tranquilizers in a water bottle given to him by an Argentine team physio. Argentina went on to win that game and got to the final as well. And they've never exactly denied what happened that day in so many words. But I always wonder, why did Branco take a water bottle from the opposition bench? That's...
Especially like, because I imagine, you know, you get the different like bottles mixed up and like, oh, it's a break. Somebody's got a water bottle. Hey, let me get a sip of that. But I do like the idea of somebody being like, no, this one is specifically for you, and yeah, not seeing that as suspicious at all. The other one that I was trying to remember, Argentina in 1978, it is very... It's too complex for me to like explain off the top of my head. I just wanted to confirm that it was Peru. But there is a story that like Peru threw a game so Argentina could advance, and then weeks later there was this like massive payment for a grain shipment from Peru to Argentina, and there's an idea that the military junta basically went in and said, hey, if you guys lose this game, it will be financially beneficial to your country, and so they did. That's another one that is very conspiratorial. No one is ever going to say that happened, but if you start connecting dots, those dots get connected easily and quickly.
Joe, any unproven conspiracy theories that we've missed off the list? Possibly any that aren't Argentinian or geopolitical?
I can do the first part of that, but not the second part. Sorry. The only one I have left that has not been said, this one is truly wild and seems really insane to me. Barcelona, back in the Pep Guardiola days, apparently during that period. Yeah, so Taylor knows where I'm going with this. I'd never heard of this until I was researching last night. A Syrian state-owned TV station claimed that Barca's formations were coded messages to arms dealers that would bring weapons to Syrian rebels. So apparently Iniesta was like the start of a route, and Lionel Messi further upfield, maybe a little bit wider, was the pickup point. Just absolutely insane stuff. That is, again, not something I'd heard of, but kind of blew my mind.
Joe, that one's true. Wake up, sheeple. What's happening? There's another Barcelona Real Madrid one that's just come to mind. The whole UEFA Lona thing, where there's an idea that Barcelona are favoured by UEFA because of their UNICEF sponsoring.
Yeah.
And this was something that was actually started by Jose Mourinho in the 2010-11 season. Real Madrid were knocked out of the Champions League by Barcelona, who were rather good that season, and you know, the best Barcelona, quite possibly. But it was Josie who said it was, yeah, basically because of advertising for UNICEF. And he said, congratulations for a wonderful football team. It must be difficult to get this power. They have managed to get this power. No one else has a chance, really. Maybe, I don't know, Didier Drogba might feel the same way about Barcelona, about that period as well. But yeah, your example there, Joe, is a wonderful one. Graham, anything else we've missed off the list? Any crazy stuff you want to talk about here?
Yeah, nothing as high stakes or geopolitical as some of the stuff that's been mentioned in this section. But I like the one about whether Steven Gerrard missed a penalty to get Roy Hodgson sacked. So Gerrard made no secret of how he didn't enjoy playing under Hodgson at Liverpool. And with the pressure really on Hodgson at the time he was at Liverpool, Liverpool were 3-1 down away to Blackburn Rovers in a game. Liverpool get a penalty as a potential way back into the match, and Gerrard misses the penalty. And well, it sure looks like he deliberately misses the penalty. It's not just the careless motion of the way he takes it, it's the way he almost turns around before it's even over the bar, and there's just no reaction from him at all. Of course, he has never admitted it or even hinted at it, because it would kind of stain his professionalism a little bit, but you watch that penalty and tell me that he doesn't mean to put that over the bar. I defy you.
There's Graham, thank you for that one, because that one is also, there's a similar one for Clint Dempsey with the U.S. national team, that there was a game in which the United States was up 2-0 over Mexico. U.S. gets a penalty, Dempsey takes it and misses it. And I know plenty of people, Daryl Grove was one of them, who firmly believed that Dempsey missed that on purpose to preserve 2-0 so that scoreline would continue to be as iconic as it is.
And it is. I think it worked. I believe that one too. I believe all of them. Thank you very much for that question, Michael. And thank you to everybody who has submitted a question. And thank you to you three gents for making such a wonderful audio recording with me today. Taylor Rockwell, thank you, sir.
Thank you, my friend.
Joe Lowry, thanks.
Right back at you.
Graham Ruthven, I think you're wonderful, and I'll take every opportunity to compliment you that I can.
Always a pleasure, right?
Thanks, listener. Bye! Slash it.